content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Steve Lord from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to a half hour of captivating developments in science, medicine, technology, and the world around us, as reported in Discover, the magazine of science. Today's episode from the March 2018 issue of Discover magazine features four stories on spacesuits, ecology, a peaceful death, and engines. A do-it-yourself spacesuit. Cameron Smith will put his suit and his life on the line at 50,000 feet. Anthropologist Cameron Smith usually digs into the past, but these days he does a lot of forward thinking. The Portland State University professor spends his spare time and money designing and building a spacesuit. He wants to make one with a price that's about 1% of a comparable NASA getup, which costs roughly $70,000. This year, he'll put his life on the line to test his design by piloting a hot air balloon by himself to about 50,000 feet, far above the altitude of commercial jetliners. Smith's designs have attracted the attention of SpaceX, but the 51-year-old isn't interested in profits. He's committed to making his spacesuit plans freely available online. Discover joined Smith at his downtown Portland condo and workshop to learn more about what drives this explorer. Question: what's an anthropologist doing designing a spacesuit? Answer: I grew up in Texas when the culture of the Apollo missions was still reverberating. But in those days, the path to space was military flying, and my eyesight wasn't perfect. So I turned to archaeology and anthropology, which took me to some really wild, remote places. I built sails for ships as part of my research and became comfortable working with textiles. And in the last decade, the proliferation of the private space industry prompted me to think about participating in some way. Many space exploration technologies can benefit from reinvention and rethinking. A lot of this hardware hasn't been reevaluated since the 1960s. Question: tell us about your upcoming balloon flights. Answer: some of my trained volunteers and I have done a handful of test flights, and we're now pulling together the resources, money, an RV, a pickup truck, to stay in the field for weeks at a time in a mobile flying camp. We'll be pushing into the 20,000 to 30,000 foot range this year. There may be things going on with a spacesuit that you don't notice until someone is looking at it from the outside. But I'll have to go up to the really high altitudes alone, because my balloon's volume provides enough buoyancy to lift only me and a lightweight life support system through that thin air. I'm going to be very cautious. You've got only about 5 to 15 seconds of useful consciousness up there without a spacesuit. I don't want to get injured or killed. Question: why not just test the spacesuit in a pressure chamber? Answer: space equivalent conditions, like those at 50,000 feet, include a major problem that's hard to replicate in pressure chambers: very low temperatures. Imagine what metals and adhesives do at minus 100 degrees Fahrenheit. I want to have my invention keep me alive in those conditions. Question: how many other people do you know of who are taking this do-it-yourself approach to spaceware? Answer: every couple of months I get an email from someone who wants to design a spacesuit. I'm happy to share a lot of what I know, but after a while, most people start to realize it's a lot of work. I don't know of anyone else who is designing a spacesuit privately. The beetle, the bird, and the tamarisk tree. Ecologists seek balance as one non-native species eradicates another. It's a hazy Sunday morning in early July as Levi Jameson pulls to the side of the road in central New Mexico. He grabs a camera, clipboard, and thick canvas insect net from the blue Volkswagen van that is his traveling home and office, and begins to hike along an irrigation ditch just east of the Rio Grande. A seemingly unending thicket of tall, shrubby tamarisk trees parallels the ditch. He stops just a few feet in, picks a tree at random, and sweeps the net over the dusty green leaves exactly 5 times. Then he peers into the canvas, quickly counting a mass of tiny Diarrhabda beetles already crawling up the fabric to escape. He scribbles the number, 160, he says, and the GPS coordinates in his notes. That's a drop from the 200 to 300 per net that he's seen here before. Jameson, a biologist now with the Colorado Plateau Research Station at Northern Arizona University, has long tracked the tamarisk leaf beetle through the Southwest. One trip, he says, these trees dripped with beetles. Whether that's a good thing depends on whom you ask. These old world beetles were imported and released in the early 2000s as a biological control for tamarisk, a once beloved Eurasian tree that now monopolizes vast stretches of western waterways. And the beetles are doing their jobs, munching away at tamarisk leaves, their only food, and leaving swaths of brown, defoliated trees in their wake. A single feast doesn't usually kill the trees. It just weakens them and temporarily halts their summer-long seed production. But repeated attacks year after year have reduced tamarisk cover by up to 50 to 90% in some places. Everyone was surprised how quickly the beetles adapted to their new home and how quickly they spread. The pretty wispy tamarisk with its scale-like leaves and delicate white or pink flowers is thought to have arrived in North America as a decorative plant sometime in the early 1800s. Toward the end of that century, federal agencies were celebrating the success of the tree, also called salt cedar, as a riverbank stabilizer that could tolerate drought. In 1930, it was a cure-all for erosion concerns in the West. Before long, it was vilified as a water-hogging monster. And by the 1950s, federal and state agencies had galvanized to bring the monster down. But tamarisk isn't quite the monster it's been made out to be. Sure, it's highly flammable, and it may salinate the soil when it drops its salty leaves, but waterhog? Turns out it uses roughly the same amount of water as native riparian trees like willows and cottonwoods. Since the middle of the 20th century, humans have dramatically altered western rivers and made it harder for native trees to compete. We've built dams and diverted water, and we've tamed the periodic floods that once spilled over riverbanks to sprout new generations of willows and cottonwoods. As we engineered the rivers, tamarisk increasingly had the upper hand. In response, some native birds, like the southwestern willow flycatcher, which loves dense shrubs along desert waterways, turn to tamarisk trees to make their nests. And for vast swaths of western rivers, tamarisks are now the only tree. They are the third most prevalent riparian tree in the West, and can grow as a monoculture. And that decreases biodiversity of other plants, wildlife, and even fungi. What's problematic is that when it grows aggressively, it dramatically changes the landscape in ways that negatively affect native fauna and flora, says University of Denver ecologist Anna Scher, who studies tamarisk and riparian restoration. Controlling tamarisk is a Herculean task. Bulldozing just creates a hydra, with multiple shoots resprouting from the roots left behind. Tamarisk survives, and even thrives, in fire. Manual removal with chainsaws and local herbicide application is prohibitively labor-intensive for landscape-scale control, and aerial herbicide sprays are expensive and kill desired vegetation. A biological control agent, four species of Diarrhabda beetles in this case, offers another tool. The U.S. Department of Agriculture began searching for a tamarisk biocontrol in the mid-1980s. By 2001, they'd launched the Tamarisk Beetle Program, releasing the insects at 10 different sites, with the caveat that no releases would be permitted within 200 miles of a known flycatcher nest. But by 2008, after an unsanctioned beetle release in southern Utah, Diarhabda carinulata reached the Virgin River, flycatcher habitat. Ecologists worried the beetles would destroy the tamarisks that this unique bird had come to rely on for nesting. And in 2010, the USDA ended the program. Since 2010, it's been impossible to transport them across state lines, says Dan Bean, an insect physiologist who's worked on the beetle release program since it began, and is now director of Colorado's Palisade Insectary. But, like all biocontrols, the insect has absolutely no respect for state boundaries. The federal government has stopped supporting the beetle program, but the beetles continue to adapt to their North American home. They've evolved to have life cycles better suited to lower latitudes, and they're still expanding into new watersheds. In some places, like central New Mexico, different Diarrhabda species overlapped for the first time this summer. As Jameson peers into his insect net, he's not worried about getting an exact count. "I don't care how many beetles are on this tree versus that tree," he says. "I just want to know if there are none, a few, or a ton of them, and the impact they're having." He wants to know if there are enough here to eat all the leaves on the trees. And there are. The beetles work in big migrating groups and produce multiple generations in a season. Right about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, we call it the rush hour, the beetles climb to the top of the trees and release a sex pheromone that travels on the wind. You get all these beetles following the smell, and they congregate and have a big party and have a ton of sex and lay eggs all over the tree, and then go do it again somewhere else, Jameson says. A month later, those eggs hatch into larvae which munch on the leaves. When they pupate into adults, they fly off to find fresh green tamarisk. Jameson finishes his sweep of the roadside site, then heads back to his van with a few beetles he'll keep as samples for genetic analysis. Sitting on the cooler that serves as his workbench, food refrigerator, and beetle storage, he fills a glass vial with ethanol to preserve the insects. Right now, there are two species on the Rio Grande that look identical, he says. One, Diarrhabda elongate, which hails from Central Asia, has been moving south from Colorado. The other, Diarrhabda sublanata, from Tunisia, has been working its way north. Just south of here, near Bosque del Apache National Wildlife Refuge, he expected to find the two species overlapping for the first time in the New World. Tamarisk and the tamarisk beetle are now permanent features of our western waterways, says Ben Bloodworth, who coordinates beetle monitoring programs across the western U.S. and Mexico for the nonprofit Tamarisk Coalition. There was never an expectation that the trees would be eradicated, he says. Rather, the goal is balance. Revegetating the riversides with native riparian willows and cottonwoods, or, if current hydrology and a changing climate just won't support those flood-adapted plants, perhaps relying on native grasses and shrubs. The name of the game now is restoration, says Jameson. Let's get these ecosystems to where the balance is tipped toward the natives doing really well and non-natives not taking over. Quest for a Peaceful Death. A cancer doctor studies the connection between spirituality and end-of-life care. When a cancer patient has run out of options, when her disease has returned and the latest experimental drug has failed, and her oncologist hasn't much to say, that's when the patient would be fortunate to meet Tracy Balboni. She's a radiation oncologist and palliative care researcher at Harvard Medical School and Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. She works at the murky stage of care known as end of life, when decisions about additional treatment can be complicated by fear and pain. Simply put, Balboni's job is to relieve the pain and provide the highest quality of life possible. Her more conventional tool is radiotherapy. Normally, radiation oncologists attack tumors with as much force as the patient can stand, in an effort to eliminate the disease. Palliative radiation oncologists like Balboni, treating advanced cases, use doses of radiation that are extremely quick. They may, for example, try to reduce a spinal tumor lest a person become paralyzed, or shrink malignant obstructions in the abdomen. You're using the technology to help patients live better, Balboni says. Today, we have patients living much longer with their cancers. Instead of 2 months, it might be 10 years. Yes, we need to cure, but in the setting where we can't cure, we need to use these tools in a way so that patients can live well as long as possible. The other powerful tool that Balboni employs is spirituality, her own, the patients, the families, and the medical staff's. Although everyone defines it differently, spirituality shapes the choices made at the bedside at the end of life. Balboni's interest in religion and spirituality stems from her work on a psychosocial study called Coping with Cancer, which began in 2002 when she graduated from medical school. The 6-year study surveyed more than 300 cancer patients who were facing death, and also included their informal caregivers, the friends or family members closely involved in their case. Study participants answered lots of questions about treatments, about doctors' and nurses' communication skills, about religious and spiritual beliefs. The investigators followed up with the caregivers some months after the patients had died. "I worked specifically on spiritual measures," Balboni says. "How did the medical team attend to the spiritual or religious needs of cancer patients? What was the impact of spirituality on the quality of their lives?" The research terms are unusually slippery. It doesn't help, Balboni concedes, that spirituality and allegiance to traditional churches are increasingly separate. All religious people can be considered spiritual, but not all spiritually minded people are religious. Keeping it simple, Balboni defines spirituality as a search for meaning and purpose, which may or may not include reference to the divine. To measure it, she uses questionnaires devised by psychologists and other researchers. The actual definition of spirituality doesn't concern Balboni as much as its importance and meaning to the patient. And particularly, she explains, its impact on whether to transition to hospice care or to receive aggressive interventions in the ICU. The choice here is stark. Some terminally ill people will fight to the last gasp. They say they want to be resuscitated if they fall unconscious. They want a ventilator if they can't breathe. The alternative is hospice care. The patient declines major interventions, and their dying is eased by pain medication. Obviously, doctors influence the decision by presenting the scientific facts. But do they address the metaphysical facts too? For example, it's been well documented, as Balboni and her colleagues noted in a recent article in the Journal of the American Medical Association, that there is a protective relationship between religious participation and people's health. Spiritual and religious support seems good for the body. The article urged doctors to pay more attention to this factor throughout the stages of care. Given that religion and spirituality are highly personal matters entwined with feelings about death, it's not surprising that doctors and nurses would avoid talking about these issues with patients. In the Coping with Cancer survey, Balboni found that in the minority of cases where spirituality and end of life were discussed with the medical team, those patients proved more willing to enter hospice care. The most counterintuitive finding that Balboni and her colleagues extracted from the survey concerned those patients who did not talk about spiritual issues with their doctors and nurses. If they looked to outside religious figures for support, pastors, fellow parishioners, and/or relatives of religious bent, they were more likely to die hooked up to the machines in intensive care than to die in hospice. Similarly, Balboni wrote, the cancer patients who relied on private, unspoken religious beliefs to manage their illness were nearly 3 times more likely to receive intensive, life-prolonging care near death and less likely to enter hospice during the final weeks of life than those without a pronounced religious sense. In other words, instead of promoting peaceful acceptance, religiosity appears to encourage a great many patients to cling to life, even at the cost of greater suffering, not to mention the higher financial expense of their hospital treatments. That was completely the reverse of what we were thinking we might find, Balboni says. Furthermore, the caregivers of such patients reported that their own bereavement was longer, and their adjustment more troubled than it was for the families that had attended the deceased through hospice care. Balboni has some hunches about these results, centering on the sanctity of life concerns of certain religious traditions. With a $2 million research grant from the John Templeton Foundation, she and her colleagues founded the Initiative on Health, Religion, and Spirituality at Harvard in order to dig deeper into these amorphous, interlocking domains and uncover their influences on patients, physicians, and physicians in training. The new work, she hopes, will put spirituality on solid ground. It's a tough construct with many dimensions, Balboni says, but you look across multiple studies for a consistency of story that's being told. If someone said to me, "Oh, you're just measuring nothing," I'd say, no, there are too many associations that we're seeing to say it's spurious and meaningless. That argument doesn't hold if you care for dying patients. Balboni's confidence in her research is buttressed by the spirituality in her own life. She and her family belong to a congregational church. Michael Balboni, her husband and primary collaborator, has a Ph.D. in theology and also did postdoctoral research at the Harvard School of Public Health. When they are not working, the couple run a program that she calls a Ministry to People in Healthcare. Aimed at medical students in the Boston area, the Longwood Christian Community provides counseling, weekly dinners, and discussion, and even residential space to the young people weighing the demands of the profession. It's a great help, even after their training, Balboni says, because it connects people with mentors, people like me who are here for the long haul. It's hard to explain, as it isn't at all typical, she says of Longwood. Its mission sounds like a 21st century update of the Hippocratic Oath. Dare I say that we try to practice what we preach? We are spiritually nurturing ourselves and others as we embark on the wonders of exploring the complexities of science and the body, of caring for the sick, and of experiencing the realities of healthcare training and practice, which can otherwise be all-consuming and even at times demoralizing. 20 Things You Didn't Know About Engines. 1. Everybody's doing the locomotion. Really? We are all engines, which by their most basic definition are machines that convert energy into motion. 2. And while you could think of animals as being engines, plants have them. Photosynthesis pathways are often described as plant engines, and biologists are particularly interested in the C4 plant engine, which was discovered in the 1960s. 3. Plants powered by C4 engines, including maize and sugarcane, typically convert atmospheric carbon dioxide more readily, thanks to novel leaf and cell structures. They also tend to produce higher yields than C3 species, which outnumber C4 species by about 30 to 1. 4. The C4 pathway evolved multiple times in different lineages, often during periods of low carbon dioxide or in semi-arid environments. The adaptation allows the plants to use scant resources, such as water and nitrogen, more efficiently. 5. And that's why scientists are using genetic modification to try to turn C3 plants into C4 powerhouses, which may prove more resilient in a drier, resource-depleted world. 6. If thinking of plants as having engines is a little out there for you, how about a really far-out fact? Black holes are the universe's most powerful engines. 7. The workings of a black hole are similar to an internal combustion engine. It consumes fuel and produces energy while remaining intact, unlike, say, an explosion. 8. How can a black hole produce energy when nothing escapes it? Well, once material falls in, there's no going back. But the black hole's extreme gravity creates the perfect environment for generating energy, just outside its boundary or horizon. 9. In 2009, two researchers proposed a highly theoretical spacecraft powered by multiple mini black holes. The smaller a black hole is, the more energy it produces. 10. While the idea caused a buzz initially, the concept remains theoretical. Quite frankly, we're more likely to have engines that run on panda poop. 11. No, seriously. In a 2016 study, researchers described how the excrement of giant pandas was ideal for biofuel production. 12. The bears digest bamboo, thanks to unique gut microbes that break down the tough plant material. Once excreted and cultured by researchers, those same bugs go to town on other plant scraps and produce a hydrogen-based biofuel. 13. That's a pretty ingenious way to fuel an engine. Both words, by the way, derive from ingentium, Latin for talent, an abstract concept. Over time, the word engine also took on the more concrete meaning of a device. 14. A device you don't see much these days is the siege engine. For millennia, these massive military weapons, such as catapults and battering rams, were a popular way to breach defenses. 15. One engine that has catapulted to fame in the last couple of decades isn't an engine at all. Search engines, programs that provide you with lists of websites based on the terms you tell it to find, aren't converting energy so much as directing curiosity. 16. In 1989, McGill University graduate student and systems administrator Alan Emtage needed an efficient way to find files spread across multiple servers. He created a program to hunt through the servers for specific content he requested. 17. Emtage's personal time saver got a big promotion when his boss recognized its potential. The McGill team expanded the program, known as Archie, a shortened form of archive, into the world's first search engine. 18. Technology gave us another engine that's not really an engine. Developers use software packages called game engines as the template for the world in which a video game is set. 19. These complex programs automatically regulate the basics of a game, from managing memory needs efficiently for smoother play to changing the lighting as a character moves through a landscape. 20. Scientists are increasingly turning to game engines in their search because the programs are, by nature, fast and efficient at tasks such as visualization. In 2017, for example, researchers designed a game engine system to identify optimal wind turbine positioning. There it is. More human ingenuity. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover, the magazine of science. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. Till then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.